Judge Riley, the Honorable Renee L. Werke presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Go ahead and take a seat. I see we continue to be our 6 feet distance, but we've gotten rid of the extra microphones for council. Anyway, all of the post-COVID things we're still getting adjusted to. Welcome, everyone. Thank you for coming today, April 28th, to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have three cases that are set for oral argument today. Attorneys, you've been here before. Podium has an up and down lever if you need to adjust it for your height. Pay attention, please, to the time frame that does appear. 15 minutes for each of you, 5 minutes rebuttal to appellate counsel if you choose to use that. With that said, I'll have our marshal call the first case.
First is Pemberton versus Pemberton, A220879.
Ms. Nordhunt, when you're ready, go ahead.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kay Nordhunt, and I represent the appellant Stephen Pemberton. Respondent described the party's marital home at trial as follows. The home is very pretty. It reminds me of a French Tudor, something you'd see perhaps in Europe. It's got a large courtyard where we sit. The home has a putting green. The home has a swimming pool. The home has lots of land. It's just a beautiful home. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous home.
Except for the gutters.
Respondent then continued, and inside the home is just as nice. It's very well cared for, very pretty. It's aging now is what people put in their homes these days, but still a very, very nice home. Respondent's appraiser opined that this 6,000 square foot home located in a cul-de-sac, which is a three-car attached garage on three-quarters of an acre, had a fair market value of $616,000 on the valuation date, to which as-is appraised value, appellant does not take issue. The parties also do not dispute the outstanding encumbrance is $416,320. Respondent wanted to keep her gorgeous home. Appellant wanted it sold. Accordingly, if not sold, the property should have been awarded to respondent at a value of $199,600. That's the equity in the home.
So this all comes down to what as is meant. I mean, isn't that what you're arguing, is that the interpretation of the appraisal that said this is the property as is was misconstrued?
It was misconstrued because there is really no basis. I mean, when you're appraising a property, you're looking at its condition. Okay, there is nothing presented by the respondent that this list buyer handyman wasn't somehow taken into consideration by the appraiser in deciding the fair market value of the home. And so we have this $131,700 deduction, which is identified as the cost of future home repairs that respondent could choose or not choose to make. So what we have here is she gets this very nice home at an assigned value of $67,980. This is error. It's no relationship to the fair market value of the home, and it bears no relationship to the equity in the home. So it should be reversed. Going back to the first point, an as-is appraisal necessarily encompasses the condition of the home on the valuation date. By providing that respondent can additionally deduct from the value of the home any later costs of repairing the condition of the present of those items present when the home was valued, what you got is an improper double dipping. Under an as-is appraisal of the home, the valuation necessarily includes the existing property condition. The appraisal itself, it's in the record and it's in our addendum. It has, you know, detailed pictures of the exterior and interior of the home. There's been no identification by the respondent that was what was presented in her trial exhibit 67, which was her handyman's list of repairs, was not apparent to the appraiser. And the appraiser who testified did not testify that the property was somehow worth $131,700 less. It's also inaccurate to state that this $131,700 is repairs. What it includes capital improvements. It includes the cost of a new roof, new furnaces.
What can we make of a remark that was recited in the court's findings that said husband testified that the home needs repairs, I mean, he acknowledged it, and then says is like taking care of a small hotel?
Right. Every home needs repairs. And he was stating that in the context.
Some more than others.
Some more than others. And the fact is, here you've got the appraiser who goes through, and there were some repairs that were needed. I mean, there was some cracks in the ceiling, there was some hinges, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a large home. And what he was stating is in the context of the fact that he wanted the home sold. I mean, why would respondent want to keep the 6,000 square foot home, which, you know, is a lot to maintain? But that in any way is somehow supports the idea that you can deduct $131,700 in determining the equity of the home.
What about, Ms. Nordhunt, the concept, you know, in tax court when people are challenging appraisals, you know, they often make the argument, well, it didn't account for deferred maintenance. And I agree, some of these numbers seem to look like capital improvements, not deferred maintenance. But why wouldn't we account for that?
Because it's already accounted for in the appraisal. In fact, the appraiser testified when asked about the deduction of any cost repairs for the rental properties, that, I mean, the normal wear and tear, et cetera, is already taken into account. So what we're talking about here is a situation where, I mean, the appraiser comes in, her appraiser comes in after she's had inspections and says, this is the fair market value. So on what basis do you
that was that years later?
No.
Okay, so that was still in 2019?
2019. So okay. She had her inspectors come in. I think it was June and July of 2019. The appraisal that's at issue was...
I thought the valuation date was December 31st, 2019.
It is, but the inspections occurred in 2019.
Oh, okay.
Okay. And then the appraisal occurred after those inspections. I think it's dated August of 2019. And that was the inspection that was utilized for the valuation date.
So the district court was free. I mean, after hearing this evidence, the district court was free to reject Mr. Beer's appraisal opinion and accept yours.
Well, actually, we're fine with the appraisal opinion of the appraiser. There's no issue there. What the problem is this after-the-fact deduction of the $131,700. I think it's important to kind of look at the record in this case and how this came about.
The way I read this, the financial experts agreed on the value, and there's no quarrel about what the mortgage or the encumbrance was.
Right.
So it's just this add back.
It's just this additional deduction of $131,000. So there's no issue.
I shouldn't say add back, deduct.
Right, right. So the parties agree on what the appraiser, the fair market value, they agree on the encumbrance. So the equity number is in agreement. It's this idea of that you can subtract from that this additional amount in determining the equity. And I think it's important to look at how all this comes about in the record. So the whole notion of the home needing repairs was introduced in the testimony of respondent when she was testifying in support of her claim for spousal maintenance and her budget. When she submitted her first proposed findings of fact, she didn't assert that the value of the home should have this $131,700 deduction. In fact, she stated the home should have the value as set out in her expert's trial exhibit 1, appendix 7, asset division, and it didn't have such a deduction. It was in respondent's second submitted proposed findings after trial that this $131,700 deduction first shows up, and then the trial court just erroneously adopts it. So in seeking post-trial relief, this is the first time respondent had any, or appellant had any ability to challenge this and said this is a windfall. Specifically asserted that you had the appraisal, I mean, it's an as-is appraisal, and now you're double counting. The trial court and appellant have asserted, well, or excuse me, respondent have asserted, well, appellant wanted to deduct the cost of repairs to the party's various rental properties, but actually that's inaccurate as the record as a whole. If you look again at the appellant's proposed findings of fact, where appellant addresses the cost of repair costs, which is his trial exhibit 507, he states in his proposed finding of fact 34 that readying these properties to be listed for sale will require significant out-of-pocket costs for the parties, citing trial exhibit 507. He asserts these out-of-pocket costs for the parties should be done prior to any listing.
So I want to back you up there. You said readying these properties. They had a lot of properties. And so what did that refer to?
Pardon me?
The parties had a lot of properties.
Right. And they were all appraised by the same appraiser.
Right.
Okay.
Readying these properties.
Readying these properties for sale was, what happened was appellant submitted a list, which is trial exhibit 507, of repairs he thought necessary if these rental properties were ordered sold.
I was wondering if it was the rental properties.
It was the rental properties.
Okay.
And so, and that would be in accord with Minnesota law. So if you're ordering the property sold, it makes sense that the parties are sharing in the costs of repairs because you're going to determine the division based on the sale. What there is no support for is what occurred here. That you give one party the property, and then you say, okay, I'm gonna give you $131,000. You can do whatever you want. You don't have to make any repairs. Okay, and I'm going to sign equity based on the speculation of what you might or might not do. I mean, I can't find any support for that. And that's why we ask reversal. Turning to the issue of the valuation of S&P and Pemberton Homes, the trial court and
the problem with credibility determinations by the trial court on that. I mean, the way I read it, the expert, your expert, I don't know how to say the name, Hargis, and the other expert, one was determined to be more credible. So what do we do with that?
No, that I think is inaccurate. Mr. Hargis was the party's financial neutral. He wasn't the appellant's expert. Mr. Kiwas was the respondent's expert. What Mr. Hargis explains to the trial court, and he didn't do a business valuation, but what he did do is he was allowed to give his valuation as to the asset, to the valuation of the businesses on an asset basis. And he and Mr. Kiwas both agree on an asset basis, S&P has no value. Okay. So initially what the trial court did is said, I'm not going to assign a value to S&P because there's a value assigned to Pemberton Homes. In any income, what happens is the commissions that appellant earns in Pemberton Homes goes into S&P as his W-2. So if you're assigning value to Pemberton Homes, that's good enough. I mean, you're really, again, double dipping, double counting. And the judge was right on that. But then she changed her mind. And she said, no, I'm going to go with Mr. Kiwas's expert opinion. Well, then we have a problem because Mr. Kiwas's expert opinion doesn't take into account goodwill, doesn't take into account Keyman. Minnesota law is clear. I mean,
there is no dispute that your client was a Keyman as far as the
he's
company.
It. I mean, yeah. He's S&P. If he's not there, there's nothing. Okay, so how then can you, under Minnesota law, assign a $119,000 value. You can't. And the judge never went back and scrutinized that. This was flagged by Mr. Harges in his expert report, and it was also brought to the trial court's attention in appellant's pretrial brief. But the trial court didn't look at that. And the case law, I mean, there's many cases. You go back to Rogers, there's by the Minnesota Supreme Court. You just don't take an expert opinion without analyzing whether does it equate with Minnesota law.
Was that discussed at trial court, the goodwill, the value of that, or the negative value of that? I mean, are we in a situation where we have to consider whether it was forfeited or not?
Well, no, because first we have Mr. Harges, who says why you do the asset value is because when you have a situation like this, really anything above that and any other valuation is goodwill. And it is. It can't be anything but personal goodwill in this case. Because when you have a one person, there's no independent value. There's nothing of value to S&P apart from appellant. There's no other employees. All the income is derived solely by what appellant does. So accordingly, I mean, so the trial court was right in the first instance in not assigning a value. But if you don't think that reasoning's right, I mean, the trial court was wrong in assigning a value on amended findings because of the issue of goodwill key man. And that also sits in Pemberton Homes. If you go to Mr. Kiwa's report, again, he doesn't talk about key man. He mentions the Nardini factors and goodwill, but he doesn't provide for it. And again, the court has an obligation to scrutinize an expert opinion, and the trial court didn't do that here.
Can you remind me, refresh my recollection? I have the original J&D in front of me, and the court is indicating that she was trying to not double count.
Right.
So then you get amended findings. What was the explanation that was given for that? Just that she changed her mind in terms of which expert, which person was more persuasive as far as that valuation?
No, she didn't really do that. What she did is she said, well, I'm just going to go with Keyless. Okay, so I mean, I don't know. She doesn't really explain why she's changing her mind. But like I said, when she does that, I mean, then that adds a whole other host of the issue of not dealing with the goodwill, et cetera.
Yep. Your time's expired. You'll have your rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Linda DeBeer, representing Pamela Pemberton, respondent and cross appellant. Turning first to the issue of the house repairs, I won't spend a lot of time on this issue because we can see that we're arguing about a lot of facts here. And whenever I feel that pull of we're re-arguing facts to this court of appeals, we know that this court defers to the trial court. And our trial court made extensive findings about the repairs. It's important, you know, she highlights our court.
Well, I mean, but Mr. Beers, the issue is not, you know, for all I know, all of these things have to be done.
Yes.
But the question is, with the original appraisal, was that, you know, I'll just use my words, was that deferred maintenance accounted for in the appraisal? And, you know, I think there's at least an argument based on Ms. Nordhunt's expert that it was.
Well, and I want to follow up also.
Yes.
I'm looking at the second page of the appraisal.
Yes.
And it says, as is. So why isn't it an error then for the judge to ding the cost by $131,000?
Your Honor,
for those repairs when the appraisal was as is.
Yes, and I don't have the appraisal in front of me, but there are words also in the appraisal that limit it and say that the appraiser doesn't inspect and doesn't crawl on the roof and doesn't perform an inspection, so it's a very superficial appraisal. This appraiser was available for cross-examination. These questions could have been asked of her at trial instead of argued afterward. It's really important to know as well that Mr. Pemberton agrees to the values of all the rental properties also appraised by that same appraiser, and makes the argument that those values should have been decreased because of needed repairs. The difference between Mr. Pemberton's case and Ms. Pemberton's case is that she provided evidence to support the costs and the needed repairs instead of just being general. And Mr. Pemberton didn't provide the court with any specific information. He agreed that the cost of the repairs and the inspection reports would come in. He had the ability to call those witnesses to further cross-examine them if he wanted. And he did none of that. So the evidence before the court is thorough about the costs that needed to be done. Not only that, but Mr. Pemberton often placed the cost higher. So for example, in his testimony, when he's describing the home as a small hotel, he says the cost of replacing that roof would be $50,000 or $60,000. And Ms. Pemberton's valuation, I believe, was $37,000 for the roof to be repaired.
But I mean, you could make you could make the argument that if your client makes all these repairs, improvements, the house actually will be worth more than what it was appraised at by Ms. Nordhunt's appraisal. And the question is, what was it worth? You know, what was it worth in December 2019? So, and again, if there's some evidence in the record that Judge Riley pointed out, it seems like, you know, I'm not sure we could say that it's clear what the court, well, excuse me, I guess we're saying it could be clear error because the court wasn't supposed to do that, do the deduct.
If it's clear error, then where is the law that says it's clear error? Because we're arguing so much about the facts. And here, you know, that question was actually asked of the appraiser during her testimony. And in their reply brief, they actually quote her saying that when the repairs are completed and when improvements are made for the rental properties, for example, to just keep them up to the expected grade, it doesn't increase the value. It's work that needs to be done, but it doesn't necessarily result in increased value.
And so that question, someone specifically said this house won't increase even if you do the house's value won't increase even if you do the $119,000.
That is our position, yes. And there isn't.
The court could be free to either reject or accept that.
And the court had so much information before it. It did. And it had testimony and it carefully weighed it. And I understand that Mr. Pemberton disagrees with the final result, but the court's findings are thorough and the evidence supports it. And he made the same type of claim himself and didn't support his claim. So I won't spend a lot more time on that. I think the cases cited by the appellant for support that the court couldn't do that are not on point. In fact, the first case of Lefke v. Lefke, it's about enforcement of an agreement that was already stipulated to. And in Stromberg, that's cited to say that there would be an increase in value if you read the actual case. The Court of Appeals, in affirming the trial court, said the trial court could reasonably have concluded that since the improvements increase the value of the home, the wife should share in those improvements. So even in that case, the Court of Appeals is affirming the trial court and not making a finding that that's a point of law, that repairs always increase value. It could have happened in that particular case.
Mr. Beers, you raised quite a few issues in your brief.
Yes.
Which ones do you want to focus on?
I was going to move on to, onto other issues, because I think it's actually more productive to focus on the ones where it's an error of law, where it's not such a fact-intensive argument. I'd like to focus on the denial of the reservation of spousal maintenance, and I'll just have a few moments on the business issues. I do want to clear up the fact that Tom Hargis at trial was not a neutral. He worked with the parties before trial, but The trial court literally says in her order for amended findings that came out on April 25th, 2022, in finding 75C, she says it's disingenuous that husband asserts the court adopt his expert's value for Pemberton Homes when it was clear his expert did not value Pemberton Homes. So Mr. Hargis did not value Pemberton Homes or S&P. He is not a business valuation expert. At trial, he was presenting the husband's scenarios. Each party had the ability to do that, to pay him to present their scenarios, but he does not do business valuation and did not do business valuation. So Ms. Pemberton hired an expert to actually do a business valuation. When the court cites not only that she's not going to adopt Mr. Hargis's opinions, but that she was frankly upset with the husband that he continued to assert it because Mr. Hargis was very clear he did not do a business valuation. So I'm going to move on from those two issues and move right into the issue of the reservation of spousal maintenance. It's, of course, within the court's broad discretion whether to award spousal maintenance or not. I do think that this case is a little bit different and can be distinguished from Prowl v. Prowl in that the court's own findings show that there's a shortfall. So the court trimmed Ms. Pemberton's budget and trimmed it down to around $14,000 per month. And even using the speculative or the just hypothetical value of 4% return, which we see all over in the cases, it's just a fictional number that gets grabbed out of the air. Even using husband's asserted 4% return on investments, there's a shortfall of about $56,000 a year. So we know that literally from the court's findings without even challenging those findings. So it's appropriate here for there to be a reservation. We are hopeful that Ms. Pemberton never needs spousal maintenance. It would be a very difficult time in her life if she had to ask for it and try collect it, because there's been enforcement problems throughout this case about spousal maintenance, about all sorts of things. But when the only means she has to support herself is the investments and the return on them, if there's another market plunge like happened in 2008 or even happened during this case in 2020, I don't know how where she's going to find herself when we know that she's going to be experiencing a shortfall every year. I think.
Well, is the shortfall, assuming the district court was right to cut the expenses, is the shortfall just depend on the 4% return versus the range that your client had, which was, you know, I think sort of 1.7 to like 2 and change? Like
we're not even contesting that. The shortfall occurs at the lowered budget, not contesting the lowered budget, and the shortfall occurs if we assume the 4% will be earned. So there's a known shortfall there. I think the error of law can be seen in the trial court's order where it's described that there's no loss of a job or illness that's going to happen here, and that's what most of the reservation cases are about. But here, the date of valuation of her assets was 2019. Trial went through 2021. We know from the affidavit of attorney's fees that years of litigation cost her nearly $500,000. And the potential changes that could come from an appeal, there's really not sound evidence before the court at this point in time what her assets are. So even at 2019, if they had not been depleted in all these years, there was an annual shortfall of $56,000 a year.
No one has made an argument for either conduct or need-based fees, right?
Well, they both requested it,
okay,
and the court
denied
it.
But, I mean, that's not an appeal.
Right. No, that's
so,
not.
I have no doubt the attorney's fees with two excellent attorneys were what they were. Wouldn't we have to say that as a matter of law, 4% return is crazy?
Yeah, it's hypothetical. I mean, we see it in all the cases because it's just grabbed out of the air. There's no support for it at all.
So we would have to say, so your range, let's say for the sake of argument, I'll just give it to you, is 2%.
Yeah.
So we would have to say as a matter of law, 4% return was an error because it should have been 2%.
Right, and that would make the shortfall greater.
What case would we cite to say that?
Curtis. So
why is that an error of law, not an abuse of discretion? I mean, I would think that the trial court would be in the best position to fashion at the time what a reasonable rate of return would be.
Well, two quick answers to that. First, all of the financial experts are very clear that this is the rate we use. They don't say it's based on analysis. They just say this is the rate we use all the time. No underlying foundation for why that rate. But under Curtis, if we're not using an actual rate, then we have to take into consideration that a person has to experience capital gains to shift their assets around to achieve that. And even Mr. Hargis said that his rates of return or his calculations are based upon pretending unrealized gains and unrealized income are available to her. So even, and again, with his calculations, if we even accept it, there's still this $56,000 a year shortfall. And if we use the 4% return, it's clearly not what she's experiencing now. So under Curtis,
I mean, you know, you could take the opposite view. I mean, if we're all going to speculate about the economy, I mean, you know, interest rates are up, which means more people will be renting, which means more people will be renting from your client's rental properties, so she'll actually make more money.
It's possible. I mean, the finding about potential income was $15,000 a year, so with a shortfall of...
Now, is that based on the three plus the Arizona?
That was based upon the rental properties awarded to her, calculated by Mr. Hargis in his trial role. There is no specific income from Arizona, but also under Curtis. Curtis talks about a continuum of liquidity and that we expect cash to be invested. We don't expect, for example, a residential home to be sold.
No, and I totally agree with you there. We're not expecting her to sell the Arizona home to maintain the Minnesota home or you know, because she's got to live off the income. I agree with that. But that also doesn't mean she can't rent the Arizona home.
She did try once, Your Honor, and there are findings about that. There was a small amount of income. There's also a large amount of damage. And I would say that this is very similar to the families in Minnesota that have a cabin up north. Do we expect them to rent it out when they're not there? That's what would be expected of her.
I guess it depends on how many repairs you make and how valuable it is and what lake it's on.
Yes. We do think, though, that the reservation of spousal maintenance, the failure to reserve was an error because on its face, within the findings, even without changing the 4% return to actual, there was a very substantial shortfall. And it was error for the court not to reserve it. There were facts within the findings she made that showed the uncertainty of the future. And it's not limited to just whether a job is uncertain or a medical condition. It's appropriate for a court to reserve maintenance for any kind of financial uncertainties in the future. I see my time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
To affirm the equity number that has been assigned by the trial court in this case has no support under Minnesota law. I could find no support elsewhere. This idea that when you have capital improvements. I mean, this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court has said capital improvements enhance the value of the home. On page 10 of my reply brief, I give a list of cases, including the fact that this court has said that a furnace, air conditioner, roof, and new driveway are capital improvements. So what has happened in this case is we have an as-is appraisal which takes into account the condition of the home. Okay, then we have, now she gets deducted $131,000 to make capital improvements which enhance the value of the home after the valuation date. It makes no sense. I mean, that's why I looked and looked and looked, and I can find no support.
Ms. Nordhahn, let's say for the sake of argument we agree with you, and we would reverse on that issue and remand. So obviously that changes the number on the equity, but, I mean, that's not going to change anything else. Presumably this would just be a short, it would be a short remand to, you know, take out or I get put back in the 119,000. And is that all that has to be? Would
right.
that affect any other numbers anywhere in this case?
Well, it would.
I mean, there's no maintenance.
Right. It would, no, it would just the final division, but no. Right. So you take out the 119 or the one, whatever, 137. I'm also asking the court to take out the 119 for S&P.
Yes, I do know that. I was okay. just talking about the house.
Yeah, just the house. So, I mean, it's a very easy
discreet
issue.
Thing to do.
You just take it out and we're good. If I could turn to the cross appeal, I mean, this is not a case of spousal maintenance. It's not a case of reservation of spousal maintenance. Under the last set of proposed findings submitted by respondents, she sought $10,751 per month in permanent spousal maintenance. And so arguing, she said she received interest income for investments accounts and she shouldn't have to deplete her assets. The trial court denied respondent spousal maintenance. She didn't appeal that. Okay, so, you know, there is no appeal of the denial of spousal maintenance. Given the fact these parties were in their late 60s at the time of trial, respondent has been awarded over $1.5 million in marital assets on top of the more than $2 million in non-marital assets. And that $2 million in non-marital assets, incidentally, doesn't include the Arizona home. So that's on top of that yet. And she can access Social Security. I mean, this simply isn't a spousal maintenance reservation case. She has much more assets than the appellant. She can provide for herself. So there's just no basis for this. As to the complaining about the 4% rate of return, if you look at, and there's a detailed explanation in my respondent's brief explaining why the 4% makes sense under all the facts of this case. Her expert was, he didn't account for the fact that there were gains that weren't included in his analysis. So, I mean, it's just not a case of reservation. As to the other issues raised, the trial court didn't abuse its discretion. A lot of them I don't really understand being raised here, like the 4%. The home, because she's not challenging the denial of spousal maintenance. So it seems like they're not really relevant. Other issues like the Venmo account and some E-Trade account, I mean, they're de minimis in this estate, and they really, the trial court did not err. So we're asking that this court reverse on the issues that we have presented to this court and affirm on the issues that have been raised by respondent on the cross appeal. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both attorneys for appearing today, arguing in support of your briefs. They were well done. The arguments were likewise well done. A decision will be issued by this court within the 90-day statutory time period.
Thank you.